Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 96. It's Monday, January 11th, 2021. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Well, folks, I find it hard not to talk about violence after the mass violent insurrection at the Capitol recently. Right-wing extremist violence has been on the rise for years, and experts on white nationalists and neo-Nazi groups say that we are seeing a cross-fertilization of these groups with more mainstream conservative groups, leading to mass radicalization of millions, which, of course, could very likely seed future violence. So I want to start the show by talking about violence as a public health issue. Well, I have a memory of about 30 years ago at the American Public Health Association annual meeting in Washington, D.C., when I took the time to have lunch with a then health commissioner of the Toledo Health Department. And I remember we had a long discussion about whether violence is or should be a public health issue. I, of course, was arguing that it should be. He was arguing that it was not. And if I recall, it was largely because public health is overwhelmed with so many other things, which in that I would agree. But nonetheless, I do believe that violence is a public health issue. And in fact, that is borne out over the years. So I would like to start with this issue from The Nation's Health, which is the official publication of the American Public Health Association. Violence interrupters using tested methods to save lives. Peace model replicated globally. Violence continues to be a major problem in America. Gun violence is 10 times more likely in the U.S. than in other high-income democratic countries. And violence overall has increased during the COVID-19 pandemic. But despite those grim facts, inroads have been made on the problem. In recent years, rather than taking a criminal justice approach to violence, more leaders have approached the problem from a public health perspective, as one that can prevent violence by reducing risk factors for exposure. One of the longest running and most studied public health approaches to gun violence is the Cure Violence Program, which uses principles of disease control to address the spread of violence. There is a lot of evidence for violence as an epidemic disease, and the science is all there, Cure Violence founder and program director Dr. Gary Slutkin said during the American Public Health Association's 2020 annual meeting and expo in October. Treating violence in this way instead of through the existing paradigm of law enforcement works. Cure Violence is distinguished from other violence reduction community programs by its commitment to framing violence as a contagion that spreads through exposure. In the same way that transmission of COVID-19 is reduced by mitigation behaviors, violence is decreased by changing learned behaviors that place people at risk. Instead of seeing some people as bad and being moralistic about it, we say that there is a health problem and that people have acquired violence as a script and a set of behaviors acquired in a contagious manner, Slutkin, an APHA member, told Nation's Health. Slutkin knows about infectious spread. He spent years as a field epidemiologist for the World Health Organization in Africa and other countries, fighting epidemics of Ebola, tuberculosis, and cholera. He started the violence reduction program, originally called Ceasefire, in Chicago in 1995. The World Health Organization's organizational structure influenced the program, which is also known as Cure Violence Global, because it is used in over a dozen countries, as well as in 20 U.S. cities. While World Health Organization guides, advises, and trains health workers in its member countries, Cure Violence guides and trains health workers in cities and communities on violence reduction. Community members, not Cure Violence staff, run the programs. Numerous studies by independent research have been published on the model. A study by the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, published in 2016, revealed a 56% drop in violence in Baltimore neighborhoods following launch of the Safe Streets program. Be it COVID-19 or violence, stopping transmission depends on three factors, according to the program model: interrupting transmission, preventing spread, and changing behavior. The model adapts methods of epidemic control by detecting and interrupting conflicts, identifying and treating the highest risk people, and changing behavioral and social norms through community programs and services. People aged 16 to 25 are targeted because statistically that age group commits most shootings. Violence interrupters are the frontline workers of the program. They live in the same community they perform outreach in and typically have had a past history of violence. Outreach activities by interrupters include visiting victims of violence at hospitals and canvassing neighborhoods that have gun violence. Interrupters have a skill set, a street knowledge we really couldn't teach someone without that background, said Damian Cook, who leads two Cure Violence pilot programs in Jacksonville, Florida. In violent communities, violent behavior can become the accepted or even expected response to small disputes, perceived slights, or insults. Another program based on the Cure Violence model is Philadelphia Ceasefire, overseen by Temple University Center for Bioethics, Urban Health and Policy at the Lewis Katz School of Medicine. Ceasefire has followed the model since 2013. Temple University researchers examined the model's effectiveness in a North Philadelphia district with high rates of gun violence, finding a 30% reduction in shootings. Marla Davis Bellamy, executive director of Philadelphia Ceasefire and part of the implementation of the Cure Violence model, said partnerships are key to successful violence reduction programs. She works with about 50 organizations and faith groups dedicated to changing behaviors. Creating the partnerships has taken years, she said. It takes time to get people on board. It takes time to cultivate relationships because you are introducing Cure Violence to people who don't know anything about it, Bellamy told the Nation's Health. The COVID-19 pandemic has created challenges for violence interrupters as they cannot visit victims of violence at their hospital beds at a time when people are often open to behavioral change. Program leaders are doing workarounds by seeking referrals from community services. Virtual meetings, meanwhile, are hampered by lack of internet access. One-on-one meetings 6 feet apart in playgrounds or parks are alternatives. The pandemic has also been associated with an uptick in violence in urban areas. During summer, homicides rose by around 50% in 20 large U.S. cities, according to data from the Council on Criminal Justice. Economic hardship and an increase in gun purchases are among the reasons given for the rise in violence. A study published in October by the University of California, Davis, estimated that from March to July, 110,000 people legally purchased new guns in the state, with buyers citing pandemic-related lawlessness as one of the reasons. Meanwhile, crowds at protests against political and social injustices have sometimes become targets of violence, leading Cure Violence to roll out a peace team model with free online training for de-escalating crowd fervor. Based on what he has seen in the past epidemics, Dr. Slutkin said he is not surprised by the increase in violence. Violence erupted in the Congo with the spread of Ebola and in Uganda with the spread of AIDS. And now violence is rising in the U.S. as health workers battle infectious disease in a politically divided country. Epidemics cause other epidemics, he said. For more information, folks, you can go to Cure Violence at www.cvg.org. Okay, well, may we find a way to live together in peace. Okay, well, let's return to COVID-19. Let's start with some statewide news. This from the Youngstown Vindicator. DeWine announces new distribution steps. Elderly Ohioans not in care facilities, school employees next in line for virus vaccine. Starting January 19th, COVID-19 vaccines will be available to the general population, starting with those ages 80 and older. Governor Mike DeWine last Thursday announced plans for distribution of the vaccine in the coming weeks, which are for the most vulnerable and most at risk to be given the vaccine. In addition to elderly Ohioans, school employees also will be getting the vaccine. DeWine said on January 19th that coronavirus vaccine will be available to individuals 80 and older who are not in nursing homes. Vaccinations continue now in nursing homes and among frontline healthcare workers. This includes healthcare workers and personnel routinely involved in the care of COVID-19 patients, emergency medical responders, and those who live and/or work in congregate settings, such as nursing homes and assisted living facilities. The vaccine requires two doses. DeWine said the age 80 and older group includes up to 450,000 residents in Ohio, and the vaccinations may come from several sources, including physicians, hospitals, and local health departments. He said he expects to have roughly 100,000 doses for elderly Ohioans over the first several weeks. DeWine said the current plan is to offer the vaccine in a step-like pattern, first to those 75 and older beginning January 25th, 70 years and older beginning February 1st, 65 years and older beginning February 8th, and so on, each week a five-year age difference. He said this plan may change depending on the size of vaccine shipments. DeWine said efforts are also being made to get the coronavirus vaccine readily available to Ohioans with congenital diseases and pre-existing conditions on January 25th. Starting in February, the Ohio Department of Health also plans to vaccinate Ohioans who work in schools as an effort to get children back in classrooms by March. DeWine said the goal is to have all students return to in-person learning by March 1st. He said for schools to have their employees be eligible, they have to indicate a return for in-person learning. DeWine said district superintendents will be contacted individually for staff size information and a plan to reopen schools. Schools have been using a variety of learning models as COVID-19 has caused staff shortages among teachers, bus drivers, and others. Some are fully in person, some fully remote, and others are using a hybrid model. Okay, well, with that, let's turn to the Lucas County update on COVID-19. Well, the average number of identified infections over the last 7 days per day has ticked up to 285 per day. That's of identified new infections. To get back to these numbers reported this high, we'd have to go back about a month. Of course, testing and such has slowed down over the holidays, so we would expect that there would be a dip there. Okay, well, let's look at the positivity rate in Lucas County. This has been subject to a lot of problems in figuring out what it is. Because apparently every month and a half or two, the Lucas County Health Department dumps, meaning reports, a huge number of tests. I assume these are mostly negative tests that are piling up in labs that have not been collected or reporting, or who knows, maybe they're accumulating for some reason at the health department. But regardless of the reason, it complicates the ability to calculate the positivity rate, which of course you have to divide the number of positives by the number of total tests. And if you're having a huge underreporting or erratic reporting of the overall number of tests, it's difficult to get a handle on what the actual positivity rate is. The positivity rate, meaning the percent of people tested that are positive. Okay, well, if you look at the most recent 2 weeks when they had a huge dump of tests, thousands and thousands of tests, even with that huge number that likely represents weeks or even a month or two prior to the last couple weeks, the positivity rate was 33%. This is very high. Supposed to try to get it down below 5% in order to indicate that you're doing adequate testing to get a handle on the epidemic. So, like I've done before, I tried to go back and I said, well, let's look back at 4 weeks. If you look at the most recent 4 weeks of data, the positivity rate is 45%. And I went back to look when the last big dump of tests were, and that was about 9 weeks or so ago. And so I looked at the last 9 weeks or 62 days to be exact. And over that 9 week period, the positivity rate was 46%. So it seems that over the last 4 to 9 weeks, the positivity rate has been hovering around 45, 46%. This is probably what we've been dealing with, something on that order. This is scary. And of course, as I've reported before, Lucas County seems to be testing quite a bit less per capita than Ohio as a whole. And if you look over this long time frame, it looks like we're doing about 600 tests per day in Lucas County. Over the last week, the turnaround time for a positive test result to make it to the Toledo Lucas County Health Department has stayed the same at an average of 3.4 days. Of course, they would like to see that definitely 24 to 48 hours, so 1 to 2 days. So we're still quite a bit beyond that, which makes contact tracing difficult. But of course, a lot of the contact tracing has been shifted to vaccination. So I need to do some inquiry to find out what's going on with contact tracing. Of course, when you're having, 285 newly identified cases on average per day, it's tough to keep up with contact tracing as well. Okay, well, let's look at the most vulnerable population in Lucas County and the country, nursing homes. We had 192 active cases in the most recent week. That was equally divided between 96 residents and 96 staff. And the positivity rate for testing in nursing homes in in Lucas County was 18%. Last week, there was a glitch in the reporting and it hadn't come out. They were late in reporting it. And that was 17.6% the previous week. And then the week before that, it was 17.2%. So we've been going up. But the positivity rate for the last couple months has been around 15% or more. So not in good territory, considering this is one of the most vulnerable populations. Okay, well, death rates, unfortunately, really can't report on those well because let's just say they're unreliable, or as the Institute for Metrics and Health Evaluation, the one that does a lot of modeling, they use the term implausible, the low number of cases that were reported over the holidays. And of course, as I've reported before, deaths lag often days and weeks, even a month or two for certain cases. So when you have like holiday breaks and stuff, you often have a lag. So that's the bad news. It's really difficult to get an idea what the actual death rate is. I suppose the good news of that is that these cases that weren't reported in earlier weeks are now being reported. So some of the death rates we're going to see the next week or two are actually slightly exaggerated because it's those extra cases that actually occurred quite a bit back but were not reported previously. Okay, well, more data problems from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services for the hospitalization and ICU occupancy data for people with COVID. I looked at the data and it was odd because the number of people in Lucas County that were hospitalized in the ICU with COVID was 249, which was the same as the week before. And when I looked at the data, I realized that actually all the data was the same. I think somebody screwed up when they posted the data file and must have duplicated the previous week. Either way, I checked the dates and there was two different dated files that had the exact same data. Okay, well, our rates had been going up, so we don't really know what's the case, but even if it's staying the same, it's at a high rate. The Ohio COVID-19 hospitalizations is holding relatively steady, so the good news is we're not seeing a large increase in Ohioan hospitalizations. Okay, well, UT is still out of school, and they're not reporting, but we have some early reports from the Lucas County schools this would be just the very beginning of the year, and of course, people were just getting back to school virtually, but they're still reporting for staff and students that were infected, and we did have 38 staff and 39 students that were reported infected in the most recent week starting out the year. Okay, and newer data, we're seeing data on how the vaccine rollout is in Ohio and Lucas County. So as of today reported, in Ohio, there were 305,000 Ohioans that were vaccinated. This represents 2.61% of the population, which is about a 1.2% increase from last week. Of course, at that rate, it's going to be the end of the year before we get there. But of course, we're hoping that rate will go up. Still, at the present time, we are getting more estimated new infections than immunizations. So if you're going to become immune to the virus, it's more likely to happen through the infectious disease process rather than the safety of a vaccine. Okay, well, in Lucas County, we've had 12,819 people got their first dose of the vaccination, and that was just under 3% of the Lucas County population. So woohoo, let's go. That's a little bit faster than what we're doing in Ohio. So in that case, compared to the state, Lucas County's doing a little bit better. Okay, well, across the country and here in Lucas County, there's been a lot of discussion and contention about reopening schools, and if so, how to do that. So I'd like to do this report from The Intercept. As virus surges, new studies suggest warning for school reopening. Since the beginning of the pandemic, one of the most contentious questions has been under what conditions it might be safe to reopen schools. Families are distressed about children suffering academically and emotionally at home, and leaders are anxious to get parents back to work, partly to aid economic recovery. The absence of good information about how the coronavirus spreads, along with a lack of federally led testing and contact tracing, has fueled massive amounts of distrust, with some suspicious that reopened schools are less safe than leadership reports, and others convinced closed schools are safer than leaders claim. Teachers and communities have organized protests both to close schools and to open them. Now, higher quality research is beginning to emerge, shedding light on the relationship between reopened schools and the spread of the virus earlier this fall. Two new studies in the U.S. that were published in the last 2 weeks suggest that when community transmission is low, reopening school buildings, at least when schools are not operating at full capacity, does not contribute much to the virus's spread. But the risks change, the researchers found, when community transmission is higher. A third study, published in early December, found that reopening Florida schools led to increased infections among school-age children, particularly among high schoolers. Florida is one of the only states to provide incident rates by age and county. One of the studies, published by two economists and one epidemiologist at Tulane University, looked at the effects of school reopening on COVID-19 hospitalization rates. The authors believe it's the first study worldwide to explore this relationship, as nearly all prior research has compared school opening to case positivity rates, a less reliable but more accessible measure. While hospitalization rates don't capture those who may still be suffering from long-term symptoms of COVID-19 or who got very ill but never sought hospital treatment, perhaps due to lack of health insurance, the researchers say it's still a more robust way of measuring real sickness in a community than case rates, which include those who are asymptomatic or have mild disease. The study found that in counties where new COVID-19 hospitalization rates were below about 40 per 100,000 per week, which was roughly 75% of U.S. counties this past summer, in-person school reopening did not lead to an increase in hospitalizations. Researchers found that in places where new hospitalizations exceeded that threshold, the school reopening picture was far less clear, and because even slight increases in transmission can have significant effects, more caution, they said, is warranted. Just to note, Lucas County at the present time has hospitalization rates over 50% higher than the rate that they were talking about, what they call high. The study comes at a moment of great upheaval as the virus reaches its most out-of-control point in the U.S., and a new, more transmissible variant, first detected by British scientists about a month ago, is spreading across the globe. Last Monday, in England, just a day after reopening schools and insisting they were safe to attend, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a strict new lockdown to contain the virus, including closing all schools for at least the next 6 weeks. Scotland made a similar announcement earlier today, with its First Minister Nicola Sturgeon extending remote learning for another month, citing the simply too high levels of community transmission and the significant uncertainty about how the new variant impacts young people. In both countries, in-person learning will remain for vulnerable students and children of essential workers. While the Tulane study only looks at rates between late August and October, a period when the researchers say they could get the cleanest estimate, the researchers noted that hospitalization rates have spiked much more over the last month amid the new surge. Study co-author Douglas Harris told The Intercept that he and his colleagues recently did a new calculation based on the latest available hospitalization rates from the week of December 14th through the 20th, and they found that 58% of U.S. counties would be safe to reopen under their threshold benchmark, down from 75% over the summer. By controlling for variables like college reopenings and state policies around social distancing, the researchers felt confident attributing the rise in hospitalization rates to K-12 schools, as opposed to other potential factors. They relied on recently released hospital data from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and health insurance claims data provided by a private organization, Change Healthcare. A second study published in late December looked at the impacts of Washington State and Michigan school reopenings on COVID-19 transmission through November. The researchers focused on positivity rates, and like the Tulane study, they found that in areas where transmission rates were low In-person schooling didn't appear to contribute to the virus's spread. But when community rates were higher, reopening schools were linked to increased spread. Michigan and Washington have been collecting data on each school district and making it public available, something many states have not done. In Michigan, the threshold linked to increased risk for reopened schools began at 21 new daily cases per 100,000, and in Washington, it was observed at just 5 new daily cases per 100,000. Today, nearly every county in both states exceeds those levels, and the majority of the country is also well beyond those November rates. So if you take the higher 21 per 100,000 in Michigan that was linked to increased rates or risks from reopened schools, Lucas County is currently about 3 times higher than that. So we're 3 times above high increased risk. Catherine Strunk, an education policy professor at Michigan State University and one of the study co-authors, told The Intercept they could not determine why the thresholds vary between the two states, though they assume differences across local contexts play a role. As a result, she and her co-authors avoided putting forth one national positivity threshold for school reopening risk, unlike what the Tulane study did with the hospitalization rates. We look for explanations and we don't have them, Strunk said, and that's part of why we don't want to give one number. The third study, focused on Florida, found that in counties among schools that reopened, student infections rose, particularly among high schoolers aged 14 to 17. The research could not distinguish within counties between students who returned to school and those who opted for remote learning. Some experts insist that schools can be safe to reopen even amid very high levels of community transmission if infection control strategies like universal masking, asymptomatic testing, and robust contact tracing are in place. I'd like to just stop there saying that we don't have a regular program of asymptomatic testing in our schools, and robust contact tracing is not likely in place that we'd meet that category, because you have to define exactly what that meant. These leaders argue that if the right investments are made into school safety, then in-person learning will have, quote, limited impact on community transmission rates, and the emergence of the new B.1.17 variant need not derail reopening plans. Others are more vocally acknowledging that, yes, reopening schools now will likely accelerate the spread of the virus in the community, but they maintain that the social, emotional, physical, and academic benefits of children could still outweigh the transmission risks, particularly for disadvantaged students. Evidence is mounting of students falling behind in their classes. On Monday, an op-ed in the Washington Post illustrated how the terms of the debate have shifted. Two epidemiologists from Johns Hopkins University wrote, "It strains credulity to claim that schools play no role in driving viral spread," and noted that multiple studies have shown school closures were associated with, quote, substantial reductions in community spread. Rather than insisting schools are safe, they argued that the benefits of in-person learning were so important that leaders should be honest about the risks posed by COVID-19 in schools so communities could more effectively tackle them. The authors recognize this is easier said than done. Frank and open conversations among stakeholders might be even more difficult than finding time and money for mitigation efforts, they wrote, identifying the charged politics around the issue. Investments in school mitigation measures like ventilation upgrades and routine testing would help. And the Biden administration, which wants to open most elementary and middle schools by the end of its first 100 days, is seeking tens of billions of dollars to aid that goal. California Governor Gavin Newsom also recently announced a plan to incentivize school reopenings by offering districts a base rate of $450 more per student. But given the state of the virus in California, it's not yet clear whether districts will bite. Vaccinating teachers, though, could hasten the process and reduce opposition from educators and their unions. In some states like Tennessee, Oregon, and Colorado, school employees have already been granted priority vaccine status. And as I just reported earlier, Ohio's going to open that up in the not-too-distant future here. Harris says he thinks this study can help inform policymakers in the spring when the new surge of the virus has hopefully dissipated. And while the spread of the new variant might be much greater by then, Harris thinks a strain that spreads more easily will likely just mean lowering their hospitalization threshold of about 40 per 100,000 somewhat. Neither the Tulane study nor the study on Washington and Michigan was able to glean which reopened school districts use which school mitigation strategies. Experts have been urging universal masking, though debate exists over whether 6 feet or 3 feet is needed for student social distancing. Quality building ventilation and routine in-school testing are also highly variable across districts and schools. Right now, there are a lot of data across or within schools on that, and that is a real shame, said Strunk. There's definitely no federal push to collect it. Okay, folks, well, for a small public health primer, let's review what the three essential services of public health are: assessment, assurance, and policy development. We're talking about assessment here. Surveillance would fall underneath that, assessing community resources and the such. Assurance would be closing gaps in services that cannot be provided in the community otherwise, and policy development is creating public policies that support health. And of course, a lot of these efforts require a lot of information and transparency and public education. Well, we had a little goof up here based on that from the Coronavirus Task Force. Deborah Birx had put out in the report that is basically leaked to the states because it's not made available to the broad public. But in that, she was claiming that the White House Task Force, that these new surges in the U.S. could be due to a U.S. variant. But over the weekend, that was on Friday, over the weekend, the CDC said, no, that's not the case. We don't have evidence for that. And she was just asserting that as a potential thing for the patterns that she's seeing. So it raises the issue that we don't have good surveillance and the fact that there's not good transparency in the data that is being made available to some people, meaning like state health departments, but not to the broader public and researchers and academicians and the like. So we need to do a better job on that. And in that same vein from the New York Times, the U.S. is blind to contagious new virus variants, scientists warn. With no robust system to identify genetic variations of the coronavirus, experts warn that the United States is woefully ill-equipped to track a dangerous new mutant, leaving health officials blind as they try to combat the grave threat. The variant, which is now surging in Britain and burdening its hospitals with new cases, is rare for now in the United States, but it has the potential to explode in the next few weeks, putting new pressures on American hospitals, some of which are already near the breaking point. The United States has no large-scale nationwide system for checking coronavirus genomes for new mutations, including the ones carried by the new variant. About 1.4 million people test positive for the virus each week, but researchers are only doing genome sequencing, a method that can definitively spot the new variant, on fewer than 3,000 of those 1.4 million tests. And that work is done by a patchwork of academic, state, and commercial laboratories. Scientists say that a national surveillance program would be able to determine just how widespread the new variant is and help contain emerging hotspots, extending the crucial window of time in which vulnerable people across the country could get vaccinated. That would cost several hundred million dollars or more. While that may seem like a steep price tag, it's a tiny fraction of the $16 trillion in economic losses that the United States is estimated to have sustained because of COVID-19. We need some sort of leadership, said Dr. Charles Chu, a researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, whose team spotted some of the first California cases of the new variant. This has to be a system that is implemented on a national level. Without that kind of dedicated support, it's simply not going to get done. With such a system in place, health officials could warn the public in affected areas and institute new measures to contend with a variant, such as using better masks, contact tracing, closing schools, or temporary lockdowns. And to do so early, rather than waiting until a new surge flooded hospitals with the sick. The incoming Biden administration may be open to the idea. The president-elect supports a national testing program that can help stop the spread of COVID-19 and find variants, said T.J. Ducklow, a spokesperson for the transition. That means more tests, increased lab capacity, and genome sequencing. This is vital to control COVID-19 and to prepare the United States to detect and stop future disease threats. Experts point to Britain as a model for what the U.S. could do. British researchers sequenced the genome, that is, the complex genetic material in a coronavirus, from up to 10% of new positive samples. Even if the U.S. sequenced just 1% of genomes from across the country, or about 2,000 new samples a day, that would shine a bright light on the new variant, as well as other variants that may emerge. But the U.S. falls short of that goal now. Over the past month, American researchers have only sequenced a few hundred genomes a day, according to GISAID, an international database where researchers share new genomes from coronaviruses. And just a few states have been responsible for most of the effort. California is in the lead with 8,900 genomes. In North Dakota, which has had more than 93,500 cases so far, researchers haven't sequenced a single genome. In March, Britain started what many American experts yearn for, a well-run national program to track mutations of the new coronavirus. The country invested £20 million, roughly $27 million, to create a scientific consortium that enlisted hospitals across the country, giving them standard procedures for sending samples to dedicated labs that would sequence their viruses. Using cloud computing, experts analyzed the mutations and figured out where each lineage of the virus fit on an evolutionary tree. What the UK has done with sequencing is, to me, the moonshot of the pandemic, said Emma Hodcroft, a molecular epidemiologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland, who helped create Next Strain, a Seattle-based project to track pathogens. They decided they were going to do sequencing, and they just stood up in an absolutely incredible program from scratch. Britain's intensive program to track the genetic evolution of the coronavirus is probably why last month it became the first country to identify the new variant, known as B.1.1.7. Britain has sequenced over 209,000 coronavirus genomes so far, nearly two-thirds of all the ones sequenced in the world. The U.S., a country five times larger, has only sequenced about 58,000 genomes. In the U.S., a constellation of labs, mostly at universities, have been analyzing coronavirus genomes since the spring. Many of them spend their own modest funds to do the work. It all comes down to these grassroots movements to get it off the ground, said Christian Anderson, a virologist at Scripps Research Institute in San Diego, whose lab's at the forefront of these efforts. Britain's robust system for genetic surveillance has allowed scientists to better understand just how dangerous the new variant is. A sobering study posted by researchers in Britain's sequencing consortium found that the country's November lockdown did a good job of driving down the transmission of ordinary variants of the coronavirus, but it did not stop the spread of B.1.1.7. Epidemiologists measure the rate of a virus spread with something called the reproductive number. If the reproductive number is 1, that means that each infected person on average passes it on to one other person. A growing epidemic has a reproductive number greater than 1, whereas a dwindling epidemic is one that has a reproductive value of less than 1. The British researchers estimated that coronaviruses other than B.1.1.7 had a reproductive number of 0.95, therefore a decreasing epidemic. That was during the lockdown, while B.1.1.7 had a reproductive number of 1.45. Yikes. The speed at which B.1.1.7 has become more common suggests that it has some biological features that make it better at spreading from one host to another. Lab experiments have shown that some of its mutations may enable the virus to latch on more successfully to cells in the airway. The British government announced that the country was going to be on even stricter lockdown than in November. You must not leave or be outside of your home except where necessary, the government said in an advisory. A nationwide surveillance program to track the evolution of the coronavirus would not only allow researchers to observe the spread of B.1.1.7, but other potential even more dangerous new mutations that emerge in its lineage. New variants could be even more efficient in infecting human cells, or worse, could evade vaccines or antiviral drugs. Just because we don't have it set up doesn't mean we can't do it, Dr. Hodcroft said. We just have to really decide this is something we want. She stressed that the only way to find these dangerous new bugs will be to watch for them constantly. They don't pop up on the first day and kind of introduce themselves and say, "Hey, watch me," she said. It takes a while for us to figure that out, and it takes us longer if we're not looking. Okay, well, I've been thinking about this whole new virus strain, and I think it might actually be best to think that these new, more infectious variants, that actually you set up two parallel epidemics, one with the previous strain, which is less infectious, and another epidemic with the new strain. So basically what this article is talking about is tracking the pandemic of the new strain. And we know from early in the pandemic that once the older, less infectious strain got into populations, in a matter of 2 or 3 months, you've got epidemic level community transmission. So now we have greater community mitigation strategies present now than at the beginning, pre-pandemic identified and responded to. But of course, it's much, much more infectious. So it's very likely that it could be a matter of weeks or up to several months before a new strain that's present to take off to really epidemic proportions, which the new parallel epidemic would be as large or larger than the old one. And of course, you can have these two going on forever. But of course, the more infectious strain eventually will become the predominant. Okay, well, as I've mentioned before, one of the real problems with this more infectious variant being out is that it could be much tougher for establishing herd immunity, because it means you need a higher proportion of the population to be immune from infection in order to prevent those who are not vaccinated or have natural immunity from previously having infection. Of course, with the new, more infectious variant, it makes it tougher to reopen schools and businesses safely. And I think one of the races that we have between these new increasing infections and getting immunity from vaccinations is we have this race, really, like for schools, for instance, the end game, although in Ohio we're trying to do in-person opening by March, I'm looking at fall, because it's pretty clear there's no chance of us getting herd immunity by anything earlier than this summer. It'd probably be a challenge by fall, and it may not even be possible by the end of the year. But either way, it's kind of a race between the increased infectiousness of these new variants and stepping up our game in mitigation strategies. Of course, the first one, particularly for preventing deaths, is getting vaccinations, because infections obviously are not nearly as much of a problem if somebody is vaccinated. Even if they were to get the infection, they're not going to get nearly as likely to have serious disease, and that's where the real problem comes in. Okay, well, under the category of stepping up our game, here's an opinion piece from Stat News. Along with vaccine rollouts, the U.S. needs a national hi-fi mask initiative. Though the first COVID-19 vaccines are now being given to healthcare workers, other frontline workers, and the elderly in the United States, it will likely be months before enough Americans are vaccinated to stop the spread of SARS-CoV-2, and with a more infectious variant called B.1.1.7 spreading globally, for which vaccine effectiveness is still unknown, much must more be done to prevent as many infections and save as many lives as possible. Wearing a mask can help do that. Wearing a mask or face covering in two high-risk scenarios can help prevent the spread of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. These include being indoors with others outside of your immediate social bubble in places like grocery stores, indoor malls, restaurants, churches, public transportation, and the like, and being outside in a crowd. While most masks provide some level of protection for the wearers and those around them, many masks, including the widely used cloth and surgical masks, only partially filter the small COVID-19 spreading particles known as aerosols that people emit when coughing, sneezing, breathing, and talking. As demonstrated in a recent study, high filtration or hi-fi masks like N95 masks are the best protection against these small particles. As a country awaits a scale-up of population immunity through vaccination, we need a national hi-fi mask initiative to churn out masks that provide more protection from droplets and aerosolized virus particles, and also reduce the number of them emitted into the environment by people infected with the virus. Wearing a hi-fi mask substantially reduces the chance of becoming infected with COVID-19 while in close contact with someone who has the disease. Two of us have direct experience with that. We wore N95 masks for the past year as we cared for COVID-19 patients and neither caught COVID-19, shown by our regular negative PCR testing. Such masks could have the same effect in indoor settings and could also help curtail super spreader events. As transmission of SARS-CoV-2 once again surges across the country, so do the odds that infectious aerosols are being emitted and linger in the air in indoor venues that people frequent. This may, to an extent, explain infections to people who were otherwise doing everything right but still got infected. We proposed the need for such masks early in the pandemic and highlighted that masks would be one way to safely get people back to school or work. In July, we co-signed an open letter calling for a national mask initiative, also that was signed by more than 70 scientists and public health advocates, including two former Senate majority leaders, two former cabinet officials, and several leading epidemiologists and infectious disease experts. Later this month, a new administration keen to act on the pandemic plans to ask for 100 days of masking. That's a good start, but the Biden administration also needs to do something in tandem, invoke the Defense Production Act to immediately scale up the production of already certified hi-fi masks, as well as accelerate the development of new designs. South Korea's government, for example, began to purchase and ship large batches of KF94 masks, which is their equivalent of N95s, early on in the pandemic to ensure that everyone had access to them. Ideally, a set of masks would be mailed to each U.S. household every month. The cost of doing so pales in comparison to the pandemic's toll on lives and the economy. The use of such masks would, in combination with other risk reduction strategies, create safer workspaces for essential workers, many who are not currently prioritized to get early vaccinations. Since the pandemic began, surgical and cloth masks have become widely available at pharmacies, grocery stores, hardware stores, online, and elsewhere. Hi-Fi masks should also be made ubiquitously available through these same venues, some of which are already coordinating with the federal government to roll out COVID-19 vaccines. Given the unprecedented scope of COVID-19 vaccination programs, the rollout may not go as smoothly as hoped. Production and supply chain issues, along with fragmented uptake, will likely mean delays until the country reaches the point of functional herd immunity. More and better masks can help us get to that point with fewer infections and deaths. With validated designs already in the market, mass production of Hi-Fi masks could be done relatively quickly. The value of a national Hi-Fi mask initiative would last long after this pandemic has been extinguished. It is only a matter of time until we face another respiratory pathogen like SARS-CoV-2, or even a potential bioweapon that could be even worse. In such scenarios, as with COVID-19, vaccines would take months to be ready. Just as every home should have a fire extinguisher, every person should have ready access to a Hi-Fi mask that can be used for protection against such threats. And I would just note that I've been advocating this for a long time. I noted this early on. It's crazy that we don't have N95 masks, that it should be a wash in them, of easily available to anybody who wants to use one. And of course, encouraging everybody to use them in those situations where they're exposed to the air of other people, the air of other people outside their own bubble of people who hopefully are safe.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, our healthcare system has been taxed in many ways by the COVID-19 epidemic, and here's a story showing just one more way that this has happened. It's from MSN.com. Why COVID-19 has left so many hospitals running low on oxygen. The demand for oxygen has skyrocketed, as critically ill COVID-19 patients often need high rates of oxygen flowing into their lungs just to keep them alive, helping them to overcome a perilous moment when their lungs are inflamed and their oxygen levels in the body become dangerously low. Problems on December 27th with hospital oxygen systems caused 5 hospitals in LA County to declare an internal disaster, which allows a facility to close its emergency room to all incoming ambulance traffic. That's a rare situation. Traditionally, when emergency rooms are full, only certain types of ambulance traffic are diverted elsewhere. Fully repairing the crippled oxygen distribution systems at aging hospitals throughout Southern California may end up being a complicated endeavor. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers last week was wrapping up assessing 11 aging Southern California hospitals in urgent need of evaluation, largely focusing on oxygen distribution systems that have had significant problems and are essentially for critical ill COVID-19 patients gasping for air as their inflamed lungs fail. Some of the oxygen systems evaluated were found to be heavily frosted just from the constant increased demand for oxygen, said Mike Peterson, spokesman for the Army Corps of Engineers. Some of the systems were in particularly rough shape, Peterson said, and the accumulation of frost and ice was significant. We're doing everything we can to keep them operating. Compressed oxygen is very cold and can freeze condensation that builds up around pipes. The freezing can worsen with ever more increasing amounts of compressed oxygen that flows through the system. Frozen pipes can lead the oxygen distribution system in a hospital to stop working. But it's not easy to remove the frost or ice that has built up around the pipes. It wouldn't be wise, for example, to take a blowtorch to melt the ice around a pipe containing compressed amounts of highly flammable purified oxygen. The Army Corps of Engineers has asked to evaluate the hospitals on December 31st and began evaluating hospitals by January 1st. Reports are being written and filed with FEMA. Initially, the Army Corps of Engineers was asked to evaluate 6 hospitals. That has since been expanded to a total of 11 hospitals. So I reported earlier that the actual supply of oxygen, meaning the production of oxygen to be able to take to the hospitals, has been limited. Now, this is actually literally the supply chain, the pipes that take from a central source oxygen through tubes to the particular hospital rooms in order to do it. And they're using so much that it's freezing the pipes. Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, I've been warning of and reporting on supply chain issues for months and months and months. Here's another one from Scientific American. New COVID vaccines need absurd amounts of material and labor. Barely a year ago, people outside of a small network of scientists and companies had even heard of mRNA vaccines. Today, millions are pinning their hopes on these genetic-based immunizations, which have taken center stage in the fight against COVID. But deficiencies in needed supplies and materials for making the vaccines could lead to widespread shortages, some scientists say. The first doses of mRNA COVID vaccines began arriving at hospitals in the U.S. and several other countries in December. An overarching question is how fast companies making them can scale up production to meet global demand. This is the first time mRNA vaccines have been authorized for use outside of clinical trials. They work by tricking the body's own cells into making a viral protein that prompts immune reactions against infection. The U.S. has granted emergency authorization for 2 COVID vaccines so far, and both rely on mRNA. A third company, headquartered in Tübingen, Germany, currently has an mRNA vaccine in late-stage clinical trials. The Trump administration reached a deal with one of the companies, Pfizer, in late December to provide 100 million additional doses to the U.S. by the end of July, resulting in twice the amount the government originally ordered. Together with its partner BioNTech, Pfizer plans to produce and distribute 1.3 billion doses globally next year, and Moderna intends to produce 500 million to 1 billion doses, of which 200 million have already been allocated to the U.S. Meeting these targets will be no easy feat. There aren't any facilities in the world that have manufactured mRNA at such a large scale before, says Maria Elena Botazzi, a virologist at Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. Pfizer and Moderna have been building supply networks to shift from clinical to large-scale production. But each step in the manufacturing process requires raw materials that, before COVID, were only produced in the amounts needed for clinical research, not sustained production of billions of doses. Such mRNA vaccines are created using much faster chemical processes than traditional vaccines made by growing weakened viruses in chicken eggs. Manufacturers start with a digital sequence of genetic building blocks for the novel coronavirus's spike protein, which the pathogen uses to enter and infect cells. Robotic assembly lines transform that sequence first into a DNA template and then into the mRNA vaccine substance. To protect the mRNA, which is highly unstable, vaccine producers pack it within an oily lipid nanoparticle, which also facilitates uptake by human cells. Inoculated cells will then make and display the viral spike on their surface so that the immune system learns to recognize and fight off the virus later. According to a November report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, much of what is needed to produce these vaccines is in short supply. During interviews with GAO staff, manufacturing plant personnel described challenges in obtaining reagents and certain chemicals, as well as glass vials, syringes, and other hardware. They also cited a shortage of fill and finish facilities, where vaccine doses are loaded into sterile containers, and a dearth of workers with the specialized skills needed to run mRNA production processes. Such resource scarcities, GAO concluded, could lead to production backlogs. Boyle singles out polymerases, a type of enzyme that convert DNA to mRNA, and ingredients used for making lipid nanoparticles, as some of the most critical raw materials for the vaccines. He also says manufacturers need better access to a rare substance called vaccinia capping enzyme, VCE, which helps keep the mRNA from degrading and give it a deceptively human appearance to prevent cells' protein-making machinery from rejecting it. Boyle's team was calculated that making the 10 pounds of VCE needed to generate 100 million mRNA vaccine doses would overwhelm the limited capacity of bioreactors, that is, containers used to carry out biochemical reactions, and cost $1.4 billion. VCE prices should fall as manufacturing processes and efforts to increase production improve, however, Boyle says. The impact of these shortages was evident in November, when Pfizer and BioNTech halved the number of doses they said they could produce globally in 2020 from 100 million to 50 million. Pfizer did not say which shortfalls had affected production, but the vice president of the company's pharmaceutical global supply chain acknowledges there was a bit of a scale-up issue in the early fall, and she says that has since been resolved. When you're running at this pace, everyone needs to scale up at the same time. Alcorn says, we need more from our suppliers, and our sites need to optimize operational performance as well. The New York Times has reported that Pfizer's new deal with the U.S. government hinges on better access to specialized materials that were not publicly disclosed by the company. But Alcorn tells Scientific American that the new and unique components needed for lipid nanoparticles are a limiting factor. Moderna did not respond to requests for comment. A wild card of the needed manufacturing scale-up is how long mRNA vaccine protection lasts. Corey Casper, CEO of the Infectious Disease Research Institute in Seattle, says experts were hoping the vaccine would stimulate antibody levels 4 to 10 times higher than those induced by natural infections. That didn't happen, he says. The mRNA vaccines work great, about 95% protection from disease in clinical trials. But if the antibodies drop quickly below a protective threshold, then people might need a booster, which would require manufacturing more vaccine. It is possible that a broader array of immune cells, including T cells, will prolong and sustain mRNA-induced protection, but that scenario still remains an open question. Fortunately, mRNA vaccines are not the only game in town. Other companies such as Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca are taking COVID vaccines made using different approaches through late-stage clinical trials. And ideally, these efforts will contribute millions of additional doses, not just for the richer nations that have so far been hoarding the near-term supply, but also for low- and middle-income countries. The latter category includes 67 nations where only 1 in 10 people may be immunized next year, according to an analysis by the People's Vaccine Alliance, an organization that includes Amnesty International and Oxfam International. It's been said many times before, but we need multiple shots on goal, Casper says. Okay, well, folks, well, you've been listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo programming. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, just for the health of it. Okay, with all the challenging news, I want to end with a couple of quick stories that are a little bit better news. This is from Science Daily. COVID-19 outcomes for patients on immunosuppressive drugs on par with non-immunosuppressed patients, study finds. People taking immunosuppressive drugs to prevent organ transplant rejection or to treat inflammatory or autoimmune diseases do not fare worse than others on average when they are hospitalized with COVID-19, according to a study from the researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. At this point, there is no indication that people taking immunosuppressive drugs for other diagnosed conditions should be concerned that their medication increases their risk for severe COVID-19, the authors concluded. And lastly, also from Science Daily, study finds time spent outdoors is associated with higher levels of happiness. A new study has found that spending time outdoors and switching off our devices is associated with higher levels of happiness during the period of COVID-19 restrictions. Previous academic studies have indicated how being outdoors, particularly in green spaces, can improve mental health by promoting more positive body image and lowering levels of depression and anxiety. Jointly led by academics from Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, Karl Landsteiner University of Health Sciences in Austria, and Perdana University in Malaysia, this new research examined how levels of happiness during a national lockdown were affected by being outdoors, the amount of daily screen time, that is, use of TV, computer, and smartphones, and feelings of loneliness. Using an experience sampling method, the researchers measured levels of happiness amongst a group of 286 adults 3 times a day at random intervals over a 21-day period. This allowed the participants to provide real in-time data rather than retrospectively, helping to avoid recall biases. The research, published in the Journal of Happiness Studies, was carried out in April 2020 when the Austrian participants were allowed to leave their homes only for specific activities, which included exercise. It found that levels of happiness were higher when participants were outdoors rather than indoors. In addition, more daily screen time and higher levels of loneliness were both associated with lower levels of happiness. The impact of loneliness on happiness was also weaker when participants were outdoors. Okay, folks, well, get out and enjoy nature. It's even more important now than before. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to queue up future shows or re-listen to this show, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can search on Facebook for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM. Like the page and you'll be notified when the audio file is available prior to actually being aired. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.